Okay, I'm going to start off with a short vater. All right. On yesterday's session, it's a Rambam. I may have done this before, I don't remember, but I had a new, going over it again, I have new insight into it, so I thought maybe I'd share it with you. The Rambam is in the Shmona Prakim in Perakor V, and in the Agdamla Masechet Avos, and he says over here, something very significant in his eyes, and yet it's very difficult to unravel what he's saying. He explains the chait of Moshe Rabbeinu. What was the chait of Moshe Rabbeinu? And the Rambam says that this is something which many people have asked before, and he said, I went a little bit out of my area, but he says, "Kvayatzano minina perik el shetiratznu kushya gedola mikushyas haTorah." We answer one of the biggest kashas in the Torah. Sherabim dibru bazeh. Many people spoke about this. Rabbi Sholem ma'al achet shechata. And many people ask, "What was Moshe Rabbeinu's chait?" He says, "V'hashvei ma'ashi amano anachnu bazeh u'ma'ashi amru ba'acherim." He says, and compare what we said and what others have said. V'emes yoredako. Okay. So I would just like to go over what the Rambam, how the Rambam explains the chait of Moshe. When you take a look at what the Rambam says, it's very confusing. Because the Rambam says like this. He says, "Vata yodei you know ki Adon harishono v'achrono Moshe Rabbeinu olav hasholom. The Adon anavim kvar amalo Hashem yisala yan lo hemantem bilag disheni." Okay. Al Hashem arisim es pi. Al Hashem lo kidashtem asi. Kol zeh v'cheto Olav HaShalom Hoya, he says, what was Moshe Rabbeinu's chait? She noto klape achas mishtei aktsavos, mi mailo achas men amailos hamidusios. Vi amesinus, keshe anota klape hakas, ba'omru shimeno amorim, mocho Hashem bo, she ish komo yichas, bifnei kahal yisro, mokum shein hakas roi bo. So he says that the chait of Moshe Rabbeinu was that he went, instead of being in the middle, but he went to one side, because the Rambam says a person must always be in the middle of the pull of the emotions. So he says Moshe Rabbeinu's chait was that there's a midas amesinus, there's a tolerance of avlanus on one side, and the other side there's kas. He says these are two poles of the emotion, and a person should always be in the middle. So he says, Moshe Rabbeinu's chait was that he was noted on one side. It was noted the kas when he said Shimon Amorim. Okay. So at first, I mean, the Rambam's pshat sounds a bit frivolous, so to speak. I mean, okay. So this was the chait of Moshe Rabbeinu, but we'll see. He goes on and says like this. He says, he says sheish kamo yichas b'fnei kal yisrael mongol shein akas robo kagon zeh b'yachas loso odom also odom chil Hashem nizah chil Hashem v'fi shekol tenu also v'dvorav kulun l'meidim mehem u'bohem mekavim liskos l'osher olam azov abo. Okay, he was the model for everybody. V'heich yovo mimeno akas. So how could he be a kohes? People couldn't understand it. Alright, v'umi maiseh ha'ro. This is evil action. Kemoshe Biyanu, v'lo yovo elo mitchuno ro mitchunos anafash. This only comes from a bad part of human nature. Aval omer binyizem risim pihu. Now, so far, it sounds like that was the chait, that people can learn from him to do the wrong thing. So he says, aval omer binyizem risim pihu kemoshe avar. Now he sounds like he didn't explain anything. He's going to start explaining again. He says like this. V'hu shehu lo hayim medabrim harmonium v'lo im mishein lo mailo. He wasn't speaking with ordinary people. That the smallest of them was like a cheskel and navi. When they saw they got angry, omru, they said, he's definitely can't have a bad midah. If he wouldn't have known that God was angry, and we really did the wrong thing before God, Yisala, lo hayakoi, he never would have gotten angry. So that's what the people would say. So now the Rambam's contradicting himself. He's saying the people would say that he wasn't Koes. First, it sounds like the Rambam's saying that the chet was that he was teaching people to be noted at Midas Hakas. And now the Rambam's saying nobody would say that he was a Koes because he was too great. So therefore they would assume that God was angry at them. So he says, V'lo motzanu l'Hashem yisala b'dibro imo b'inyin zekas v'lo rogas. But we look at the Pesukim, it doesn't say that God got angry. Because it says they complained about the water. And then the Pasuk says, so God said, Kach eso eido, hakel eso eido, it says, after the 40 years. After the 40 years. And this was really after the 40 years, after the Mesei Midbar. And then it says, okay. Then it says, So the Rambam says we don't find that Kadosh Baruch Hu got angry here. Okay, so now we're totally confused. I mean, so what was the Rambam saying? What was the chet? He can't say the chet was that he expressed a bad midah because that the Rambam says they'd say he never had a bad midah. So you can't have a chil Hashem. People don't. The person does something wrong, but no one knows he's doing something wrong. So where's the chil Hashem? I mean. So what was wrong? So what was wrong was they thought the guy was angry. What's the chet? What's his answer? The pshat is like this. What the Rambam is saying is that there's two components to a chet. There are two components to a chet. One component of a chet is the source of the chet in terms of the midah of the person. In other words, if a person would create a chil Hashem, but in fact you can't trace it to any weakness in the individual, so he's an honest Rahmana Patre. Can't help it. Okay? We have to act in accordance with the method and the derech and the ashkofa that the Torah gave us and the knowledge that we have. If we do that and a chil Hashem results, that's not our fault. Okay? So that's honest Rahman Patra. So every chet has two components. One component is the weakness of the human being, where the human being erred. That's one component. And that itself is not enough either. It's not a chet. Even if a person should do something which is bad, he's not necessarily over an avera unless something occurs. You understand what I'm saying? It's an interesting. In other words, if nothing occurs, like give me an example. There's a beautiful Gemara that supports this idea. I think this is part of the Rambam's concept has a lot of facets to it. But like the Gemara says, for instance, in Shabbos Daf Kuf Hamid Beis, the Gemara says that Rabbi Shimon ben Loza Omer Mishum Rav Chilfa Bar Igra Shama Mishum Rav Yochanan Ben Uri. Hamekareya begodav b'chamoso, a person that tears his begodim because he's angry. Hameshaber kelim b'chamoso, a person that breaks kelim in his anger. Hamefazer ma'osa b'chamoso, he throws his money around because he's angry. So he says, Yehei beinechok over the varazar. Okay, so you say, so stop there, you'd say, yeah, it's a terrible thing. He's like, he's an over the varazar. You'll find reasons, there are many reasons. Says, but then the Gemara continues. The Gemara says, Shekachum nasa shel yetzer hara. Hayom omolah say kach, ulamoch omolah say kach, ach omolah avod avod azora, v'holich loved. So now Gemara seems to be retracting. Gemara seems to be saying, so what he did isn't really. It says, yeh be'inecha kovarza. It doesn't mean that what he did there. I mean, a lot of darshanim want to say pshat. That's like over azora, because he breaks the thing, so he thinks that he's blaming the thing, and it's like over azora. I mean, whatever, there's a lot of pshatim that they say. But these pshatim really don't hold any water in terms of the actual pshat in the Gemara, because the Gemara doesn't say that action. It says, why is Kilo over azora? Because today he tells you to do this, and thus it's only because of the osid that it's yiyah be'inecha kovarza, not because of what he did. It's an interesting thing. Why not? Because the answer is that if a person loses himself, so in the losing of himself is not a chet, so he lost himself. In order to have a chet, there must be something concrete that was done, that was so to speak accomplished in a bad way. You understand what I'm saying? But just because a person lost himself, that's not a chet. But the Gemara says a person that's prone to that eventually is going to do the worst thing. And of course, the worst thing is the worst thing in the Torah is always avodah zarah. Always, everything always traced back to avodah zarah. But that's a separate idea. But basically, what the Gemara is saying over here is that if a person the losing of the self in itself is basically nothing. So he lost himself. There's no avera there. But if a person does that, it shows you that his makeup is such that one day it's going to get him. You see. So the Gemara is saying there basically is that, and that's exactly what the Rambam is saying over here, that in order to have a chet, you need two components. You need to trace it to the weakness of the person, but it has to be something. If nothing happened other than the person was weak, that's not an avera. God doesn't count this as an avera. Is it something which is bad? Yeah, why? Because al shem osi. Unless the person takes control of himself, I mean, it's going to happen. Eventually it's going to happen. Shekachum nasa shel yetzahar. It means that's the umnas of the yetzahar is, he breaks him down on the first level, and then eventually he's going to do a serious fate. But what that Gemara is saying is exactly what the Rambam is saying over here, that there are two components to fate. One component is it has to be traceable to a weakness, and the other component is a chet. The person just lost himself, there's no chet, he didn't do any chet. At this point, there's no chet. Shame on us, it's something else. You see. I don't understand how Chazal analyzed a chet. What? Because the chet is that he is falling into the hands of the Yetzirah, into the umnosos of the Yetzirah. You understand? But it's not a chet per se. It's not a chet per se. Chazal are very precise on how they categorize evil. Evil is the evil and good. I mean, it's a study of kolotar kolah, and you have to be precise in what you're saying. Just to say a person did something is nonsense. Okay. Chazal don't say that. Chazal do not. This Chazal thing is one which is commonly misunderstood. People think that if you do this, you're an over the and they try to trace it to some kind of thing that at that moment you're over. That's nonsense. I mean, the Chazal say the contrary. That he said lost himself. No. But if you do, that means the avera is that you're falling into the umnosos shel yetzahara. That's the avera. And the future is going to cause serious problems if the person doesn't correct himself. But per se, he didn't do anything. So he's not chayav anything. That's basically what Chazal is saying. It's an amazing. And that's really a component of what the Rambam is saying over here. The Rambam's explanation, you'll see, when you develop it, is multifarious and multifaceted. Multifaceted, but this is one of the facets, namely that a chet has two components. It has to be traced to the weakness and what he did. If he didn't do anything, so there's no chet. You understand? So what the Rambam is saying is like this, that with the chet over here is has two components. The first component is that he was, what happened, the tragedy, there's the tragedy of what occurred, and then the fact that it was traceable to Moshe's weakness. That then you have a complete chet. You must have both components. Now, so that's why the Rambam says. That's what the Rambam starts off, and he says that the traceable element was to Moshe Rabbeinu's weakness. That he was nota. He went out of the equilibrium. He lost his equilibrium, and he was nota to tzarakas when he said Shimon Amorim. But now he starts over again. He says like this. That's the first part. Now he says, when he starts with Aval Amru, now he's going to what the tragedy was. You see, that's why it says Aval Amru be'inyan zeh merisim pi hu kemo she'avair. He sounds like he's starting off. Didn't you explain it already? No. Now he says, I'll tell you what the tragedy is. I just told you what the source is. Okay. Now what is the tragedy? It is an amazing, phenomenal pshat of the Rambam. The phenomenal pshat of the Rambam is, the Rambam says, there's a whole different view here. The Rambam doesn't go like the other sheikhs that trace it to whether he spoke to the soul or he hit the soul. The Rambam says that the tragedy was that Moshe Rabbeinu second-guessed HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He assumed he knew what God had in mind. The truth of the matter is that God did not have in mind this time to really to reprimand Kol Yisrael. That wasn't the plan. Miriam died. They lost the Be'er. They lost the Mayim, and they tainted, and they came with their tainas. But this time, HaKadosh Baruch Hu was going to give them the Mayim. He wasn't angry. He was going to give them the Mayim, and on the contrary, through their recognition of Chesed Hashem, there would be a special bond between Klal Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and Moshe Rabbeinu would be able to lead them into Eretz Canaan, into Eretz Yisrael. That was really the plan. That was the plan. But Moshe Rabbeinu assumed incorrectly that HaKadosh Baruch Hu would be angry. And he said, Shimu no hamorim, but he was wrong. Which shows a person that no matter how great a person is, even the Adon HaNeviim himself can never figure out what Chochmas HaKadosh Baruch Hu is. The Sfunaso and Cheker, and you can't know. But if that, and had he not been noted, that's why he says that people wouldn't say that Moshe Rabbeinu was a Kaisen, because they looked up to him so much. So therefore they said HaKadosh Baruch Hu was angry. Once they thought HaKadosh Baruch Hu was angry, it broke the bond. Broke the bond, so going into Eretz Yisrael at that moment became impossible. So Moshe Rabbeinu ruined the plan. Basically, he ruined the plan. And that's why the beauty of the Rambam's pshat is that everybody learns pshat that it was an onish for Moshe. Separate onish for Moshe, you see? Separate onish for Moshe. So the question is, Moshe Rabbeinu is punished, so why did Klal Yisrael have to suffer? I mean, now you can't bring this nation in. Yeah, but everybody knows if Moshe Rabbeinu would have brought in the nation, it would have been better for everybody, for all Klal Yisrael. That would be Mashiach, and that would be the ultimate Gula would have occurred. So Yan La Manta be like the Sheni. So why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu punish Klal Yisrael? So the answer is what the Rambam is saying is it was a natural unfolding, a natural process. HaKadosh Baruch Hu had a plan in mind. Moshe Rabbeinu destroyed the plan because now there was no Achdus between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Klal Yisrael. They didn't relate to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the way that they were supposed to, and the whole plan of going to Eretz Yisrael was based on that yachas between Klal Yisrael and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which Moshe Rabbeinu destroyed. And that's why he couldn't lead the people, because that was the plan. That plan was gone. Now a new plan had to be set up, and that was with Yeshua ben Nun. Okay. According to the Rambam, that's what the Rambam says, that which Rabbi and many people said pshatim, and look into what we're saying, look to what they're saying, because the Rambam's answer encompasses the whole sphere. I mean, it explains the whole phenomenon, not just in terms of Moshe Rabbeinu, but in terms of Klal Yisrael and the whole plan that God had and that was impossible to bring about. And now a new plan had to be established. That's Yeshua ben Nun. That's the Rambam's shot. Okay. Yes. So, yeah, but there's a very interesting thing here. I mean, it's a very interesting thing. The interesting thing is that most people, when they learn the Rambam, and the Rambam, where the Rambam says that when you perfect your midos, so a person should always be in the center of the two poles, see, of the two draws, of the opposite draws of the emotions, and a person should be properly centered. So most people, when they study the Rambam, so they feel, okay, and Rambam says that's the perfection of an Amoritz, that even an Amoritz can have this perfection. So most people, especially people of learning, tend to look down at that and think that this is, all right, it's a good thing for an Amoritz, but, the main thing is, I'm a big Talmud Chacham, and I certainly don't have to worry about that. But what the Rambam shows is how important two things. First of all, how important that perfection is, and how much the Rambam holds from that perfection, and that even the Adon HaNeviim lost out, and then all of Pasha lost out because of the fact that he lost the equilibrium. An amazing thing. It's an amazing thing when you think about it. People don't look at the Rambam that way because people look at the Rambam as a philosopher. And like we mentioned, I think, last time, a philosopher, there's the Yetzer Hara of an Amoritz, and there's the Yetzer Hara of a Talmud Chacham, too. in my mind, the Yetzer of a Talmud Chacham is that he feels superior, that he can escape difficult work by running into the world of Chachma. But you can't. I mean, you see from the Yadis, you can't. There's no such thing. It's a person. I mean, Chazal say, that's what Chazal say, and then on this week's Parsha, Oz Yashir, Yisrael, Oz Hashir, Oz Oz, Ali Ve'er, Enolah, and Chazal say that when a person is the whole process through which a person becomes a Talmud Chacham, Mi Midbar, he makes himself like a Midbar, Matana, Kadosh Baruch Hu gives him a Chachma, Mi Matana Nachaliel, and then once he has Torah, then he's Nochel Keo, he arrives at Yedias Hashem, the ultimate level, and then Mi Nachaliel Bamos, and then they mile him to Gedula, but Mi Bamos Hagai. If he doesn't properly receive the Gedula, but it becomes a part of his own ego, his own vanity and his conceit, then it's Mibamos Hagai. So then he goes down. So Chazal really show you that everyone, there is no one that is exempt from any area of perfection. And for a person to feel that, because this is really the Yetzer Hara of a Ben Torah. Torah feels, you know, look, I'm a Torah, I'm right. That's good for Namaris, that good news. Me, I'm in Torah, I learn to take some very deep, I'm a big philosopher, big thinker, big Chacham, yeah. But the truth of the matter is, the Rambam shows you exactly the opposite. And Moshe Rabbeinu, the Adon HaNeviim, why did he lose out? Because a Nida, the perfection of the Am HaOretz, was lacking, and because of that, you see, because of that, he committed a terrible chet. It shows you another thing also, that in terms of the equilibrium, it's not something which a person just gains. In other words, the way the Rambam talks about it in the Yad, so it's a type of thing which you have to train yourself to be in the center, you see? So you get the implication from that it's a process you go through, and then you finish with it, you know? Then you move on to the higher sphere. Okay, we took care of that. Now we move into learning and Chochmah, and being a big Chacham and learning and perceiving Chachmas Hashem, and that's behind us already. The Rambam shows you it's never behind you. The Rambam shows you that even a person like Moshe Rabbeinu, who certainly perfected himself to the nth degree possible in every area of the Midos, but he lost vigilance, and it was a momentary lapse, even a momentary loss of equilibrium can result in destruction. It's an amazing thing. So it's not something which you simply attain and have in your pocket, so to speak, and you can just forget about it, but it's something which is constantly there, and a momentary lapse can result in disaster. That's basically what the Rambam's interpretation. Yes?
The momentary lapse.
That's another facet of the Rambam's pshat. What the Rambam is saying is that a lapse in the midah causes a person to have a blind spot in the chachma, and because he was noted to meet a sakaz when he said shimunu amorim, he became presumptuous and assumed he understood the cheshbon of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So there, that's basically what the Rambam is saying, that the emotional lapse results in a blind spot in terms of Yedias Hashem, and because of that blind spot, he destroyed the whole plan. That's basically what the Rambam says. So it's traceable, but the Rambam is showing you, and the reason why the Rambam brings it here is precisely because he wants to show you: don't underestimate what we're saying over here. I mean, I can't say what the Rambam had in mind when he wrote that for that purpose, but certainly it serves that purpose where he shows you, maybe you thought we understood it before, but I didn't the way I understood this until this part. But it's tied in. He's showing you a dimension of the whole idea of being in this, being centered, being having, maintaining emotional equilibrium, which really shows you that a person, no matter how advanced he is, in this existence, the emotions are extremely powerful, and unless the emotions are in line, the person will he could be the biggest chacham, but his mind will be blinded and he will not be able to see Chachma, and he could be and he'll be totally destroyed. So the bottom line, a person in this existence cannot take for granted the fact that he is an emotional being, and that the emotions are extremely powerful, and if they're not in line, then his mind is going to be blinded and he'll never be able to see the truth. I mean, and that's what happened. To all the Chachamim. I mean, all the Christian philosophers and the Arabian philosophers who wrote things which are completely connected to the Torah. Why? They're very smart people, very highly intelligent, but they were destroyed by the emotions. The emotions created blind spots, and they could not see the emes. That's basically Yesod Nyadas. Yeah. Yan lo hamantem bi. Yeah. Yan lo hamantem bi is a beautiful say. See the thing? The chait was multifaceted. Yan lo ham yeshkef. Thanks for bringing out. I really want to bring out these points because I would have missed. Yan lo hamantem bi means what is yan lo hamantem? See the different aspects of the chait. Yan lo hamantem bi means if you would have really had a munah, you would have known that you can't have no right to be presumptuous when it comes to God's decision. You see, that's Yan La Mantam B. God says, if you would have really had a Muna in me, so then you wouldn't have been presumptuous. So you assumed you knew, God says, you assumed you knew my plan. That's not a Muna. That's not a Muna. What is a Muna really? A Muna is, there's Yediyah and there's a Muna. Yediyah means where your mind grasps the truth, and emunah means where your mind knows that something is true, although you can't grasp it. So with regard to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, there is a small amount of yediyah and a large amount of emunah. Because whatever we know is small, but we know enough to know that God exists, and we know enough to know that God's knowledge is the ultimate lishuna sayin cheker, and because we know this, so we have to act in a certain way. But in specific, it's all amunah. That's yan lo amantambi. That's what yan lo amantambi lag yishin yileini b'nei Yisrael means. You lacked in your amunah, because if your amunah were really on the highest level, you wouldn't have presumed you know what I have in mind. That's basically that's what the pasuk says. The pasuk is beautiful. The pasuk brings out, on the contrary, what the Torah did in the criticism in the Yod. That's why I say the criticism is on many levels, because there are different facets to it. But the Torah brought out this facet because the Torah converted the chait of Moshe into a kiddush Hashem, because it showed that even Moshe Rabbeinu had no right to assume that he knew the cheshbon of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So the criticism, really, in the criticism was a removal of the chait and created a greater kiddush Hashem. But nevertheless, because the plan was thwarted, so it was impossible to proceed with that plan. That's Yan Lo Amantem Bi L'Hagdishin L'Lei B'nei Yisrael. That's what it means. If you would have had a Muna, if a Muna were there, you couldn't have done this. The end of the chait, one of the aspects of the chait, was, and when you look at it, that really is the essential aspect, because the bad emotion created a lack in Yedias Hashem, which is ultimately the greatest fate. So the Torah really went to the heart of what happened in terms of Moshe Rabbeinu. You see, it does, as a matter of fact, that is really the essence. It's secondary, even though, of course, it's in terms of the planets, it's primary. But in terms of the chait of Moshe Rabbeinu, what was the ultimate chait? That he had a blind spot in Yedias Hashem. Yeah. There are two. That's what I'm trying to tell you. That there are different ways to analyze a chait from different perspectives. If you want to trace it to the core, that's one way of analyzing it. If you want to look at what the essence of what happened, that's another way of analyzing. You understand what I'm saying? There are different aspects to the chait. The Torah is bringing out the aspect which is most significant in terms of the ultimate result. If you want to trace the cause, that's what the Rambam's doing. Okay? It's a there are different, you understand what I'm saying? It's multifaceted. Yeah, there's different ways of there are different priorities when you view it from different, in different frameworks. You understand? The Torah is presenting it in this framework. Because you could say, simply, if there were enough emuna, it wouldn't have occurred. That's not the same thing as tracing the cause and the history of the chait. There's one way of tracing the chait in terms of the history of the individual. Another way is in terms of the objective framework. In terms of the objective framework, it's yama mantan bilag disheni. That was the ultimate chait. Okay, yes. An example from human affairs of emuna would be emunas chachamim, which means you go to a doctor, you may know you don't understand the prescription, but you know that it was telling you is right. Okay. In my opinion, it's one of the yesodos of nevuah. When you read the nevuah, one of the yesodos of nevuah, the amazing thing about nevuah is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu shares with the Navi how he judges the world. And that's basically the Sefer Nevuah. That's from the starts with Avram Avinu. Hamachasani ma'avram ashani yosa. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu shares with the Navi, to some degree, how he judges the world. And he allows the Navi to communicate with him, to have a correspondence with HaKadosh Baruch Hu on whether that's right or wrong. I mean, it's an amazing, but that's really Yesod of Nevuah. It's an amazing thing. Okay. Anyway, it has to do with... It's not completely, what we're doing today is not completely unrelated to this shiur on the chait of Moshe Rabbeinu, the way the Rambam explains it. Because it has a lot to do with the, this area has a lot to do with the perfection insofar as the emotional equilibrium of the person. Yeah. Interconnected system. But actually, it's even closer. Because a Rav and a Talmud or a Talmidim, I mean, is really like an Avim Bonim. I mean, what did Moshe Rabbeinu say? Nochi Rishis Almazeh. So you see, Moshe Rabbeinu already said that it's like raising children. That's it. So, I mean, you can't say it any more descriptively. Right? So, the description is identical. So you see that Moshe Rabbeinu recognized that raising children is a very difficult thing. Didn't want the job. And he lost his equilibrium in that sphere. In that sphere of raising Klal Yisrael, I mean, it was a momentary lapse. And unfortunately it led to a big tragedy. Big tragedy. But anyway, the thing is that this area, obviously is one where we realize that it's extremely important to maintain one's equilibrium, and it's extremely difficult. Okay, so yeah, certain questions. I'm going to go by the questions that were given to me because I think they really are. I want to commend the people that sent in the questions because they're really excellent questions. I don't know if it's mentioned. I don't know if they want the names. No, but the questions are very pertinent, I mean, practical, and they also open up areas that have to be discussed and analyzed. I'll just start off again. I think I said last time, I don't remember what I said last time, but I think we said last time that the most basic premises, few premises, but of course, when raising a child, a person must have knowledge of the child. It's extremely important. When I say knowledge of the child, everybody thinks they have knowledge of the child. But what I mean in specific is to have knowledge of a certain amount of knowledge of the world of the child. That is the first thing that a person would seem rationally, a person would have to have, okay? And it doesn't seem to be an unreasonable demand. But a person must have knowledge of the world. If a person wants to guide the child and raise the child properly, they must go into the mind of the child. Because they don't have the mind of the child, so then whatever they're doing is based on nonsense, based on extraneous frameworks, which have nothing to do with the child, and obviously cannot help the child. Okay? Just like if a person is a horse trainer, he has to know the world of a horse. He has to understand how a horse works and what its motivations are, and I mean, and its physical structure and everything else about it. And we know that that's the only way a person could be a good trainer. So a child is certainly not a horse, but a child is a different world than our world. In the world of the adult, it's different. And so far as it's different, it's the same thing. It's something completely different. And just like you would recognize that horse training is something different, and you have to get into the world of understanding how a horse operates, so too a person must realize his world is completely different, and if he's just going to stick in his world, he's not going to have a chance of raising a child properly. So that, I would say, is the first premise. The second premise is just as important. And the second premise is that in raising a child, you also have to realize that if you don't have knowledge of yourself and your own involvement and the way you relate to raising the child because of your own motivations and instincts, then you're equally capable of damaging the child. Because you could know the world of the child, but you don't know your world. If you don't know your world and you don't know yourself, then you are prone to disaster. Okay, because you cannot, you may be lucky, some people, you know, I mean, people will say, well, look at him, he's raised, he's okay. First of all, as I said last time, you don't really know who's okay, who's not okay, because that's an internal situation. So you cannot, it's very, you see, in the areas of science, it's easy. It was easy, but in spite of that, when you look back, you see how difficult it was for Albert Einstein to prove relativity, okay? But in spite of the fact that whatever he did was based upon observable scientific evidence, in spite of that, it was years and years until he succeeded in being recognized as having discovered the true idea. Okay? Because man by nature doesn't like ideas, new ideas, and ideas that are removed from physical reality. He goes against it. And in spite of the fact that was pure science, it was great difficulty when you read the history of him establishing that what he said was correct. Unbelievable difficulty. So kal vachomer ben benosh kal vachomer in an area of the human mind where you can't really produce laboratory experiments as you can in the other areas. So here you really have to be perfected in terms of your own mind and your own ability to investigate and analyze. And if you don't have that, it's just hopeless. Okay. So, therefore, I say a person, the most important characteristic a person has to have is honesty. Honesty, I say, is primary. Because honesty is the one thing, and honesty to me means to use a little deeper definition or description of honesty, I would say a love for Emmaus, a love to be in line with Emmaus. And that love to be in line with Emmaus has to supersede all the other emotional motivations that we have, okay? That we all have. I mean, and if you don't, that's the one thing that you have to you need to count on to be successful. A person, I would say like this. First, I start off. I say like this: that a person must realize that the only pure love, and this is the only pure love that exists, is the love of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And there is no other pure love. Every other love that we have in our lives is tainted. It's tainted because there is always some kind of ulterior motive or benefit, instinctual trade-off that exists. And really, I mean, and even the love of a child, which one would say is the purest love, perhaps, the love of a child, nevertheless, the Torah says openly that that love is not like the love of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And it's really, it's a parsha in the Torah. Where's the parsha? What does that mean? That means that the Yitzchak, the love of Yitzchak is great, but that's still nothing compared to the love of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's it. Kachnas binchas yichidcha asher ahavta. The Rav one time said, what does the Akedah show? The Akedah shows that Avraham Avinu could live without Yitzchak, but he couldn't live without HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That sums it up. But even more so, it's on an account level of the incidents of the Torah, of the narrative of the Torah. But it's also mentioned not simply as a narrative, but as an overt and open injunction. And where is that? Where is that? Open. Open to the Torah is in the form of a mitzvah, not just simply what? No. V'ahavta eis Hashem elokecha b'chol levavcha b'chol nafshecha b'chol modecha. What does that mean? That means there's nothing left. That's it. Okay? I mean, it's plain shot. Okay? So it means the only real love, the only all-consuming love, is the love of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Every other love is taken. All right. That's really the mistake of this society. The reason, of course, is because that's the only love that involves the highest and most essential part of man, the Tzelem Elokim. Everything else involves other areas of man, man's emotions, but the Tzelem Elokim is involved only in Avas Hashem, and that's the greatest draw, and that's the essence of man. That's the most powerful love, and it's the only real love. Okay. So, therefore, a person must realize that in every other area, basically, their own emotions are involved, and they have their own ulterior gains and benefits. Now, that's why insofar as I mentioned this society is concerned, that's really the mistake of the society. What's the mistake of the society? The mistake of the society is that they think they can find the essence of their existence either in romantic love or in love of family. I mean, that's basically, I don't care what form of exposure you have to what's going on in this society, but that is the bottom line in this society. What's the philosophy of the society? You'll find happiness either through romantic love or through love of the family, okay? Or through both. But that premise, according to Yahadis, can never lead to happiness. Impossible. Because it does not involve the essence of man, and the only love that could lead a person to happiness is Avas Hashem. Because that's the thing that really encompasses the essence of man in the highest degree, and that's the only thing that will give him satisfaction, and it's the only thing that's real, and the only thing that's true. Okay, so at any rate, getting back to the practical, I think this is important in view of some of the questions that were raised there. Now, let me just think for a moment. One of the questions is like this. Let me read the question, please. The one who asked the question phrased it as follows. All right. How should a proper parent feel about his or her children? Detached, but also enjoying and loving them. Fully loving and not maintaining a sense of detachment. Because we could see there being something wrong with someone being gaga over their kids. At the other end of the spectrum, we could see someone arguing that there is an objective sense. Nothing to love about an infant or toddler. Okay, so basically the person wants to know, the question is, what should a person's feelings, this is an important question. What should a person's feelings, a basic question, how should a person's feelings be towards a child? Okay, so as I said, of course in this society, that's the ultimate experience. I mean, because people want to show someone has a good life. They show they love their children. They show pictures of them and their children and videos and look what a wonderful life they have. See, they love their children. This is the ultimate love. Okay. But the truth of the matter is that in Yahadus we know this is not true. And we know that yet, the other side of the coin, which I think is what the questioner is asking, the other side of the coin to say, well, look, raising children is just purely an obligation. I don't care about the child, and it's just my obligation to raise a child. All right? And therefore, we'll just go about this task and get finished with it already. Okay. So, it takes a long time, right? So my answer is as follows. My answer is that we have to understand, and we have to know, like the Rambam says, that the things that we have in our emotional life, really, although they serve our own enjoyment, our own goals, in a sense, but obviously there's a bigger goal. Okay, there's a bigger goal. Like the Rambam says about the sexual pleasure. Sexual pleasure is the most powerful driving force. Yeah, but we know a person as a chacham realizes, and he sees it not just in himself, he sees it's in the min, and not just in the min, but in the other min, and not just in the other min, which are balechayim like us, but even in plant life. And the force of propagation is built into nature. So that we are just an incident in this powerful force. And obviously, it's not there for our enjoyment, but it's there for the kingdom I'm in. But in the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu worked out the world, he worked it out in a way that there is a pleasure involved. There is a pleasure, there is an enjoyment. And the same thing is true with regard to raising children as well. That in my opinion, I mean, I can't prove it, but in my opinion, the reason why a child is so cute to the parent is also something that was implanted in nature so that the parent should raise the child. I mean, if that attraction, that cuteness weren't there, I don't know how many parents would really... okay? and you see that everybody recognizes... Even though everybody's convinced that their baby is objectively the most beautiful and most cute in the world, but they also know that when it comes to others, this is not necessarily so. But the fact remains that we do recognize that God created us in a way that the system is guaranteed, so to speak, to go on because he didn't trust our sense of ethical perfection and philosophy to be involved in Kiyam Amin, Lishma. Okay? So there are side benefits, and there are benefits and enjoyments. Now, I think the way that a Chacham has to look at that is not to deny the situation that a Kadosh Baruch Hu gave to us, because his das is the ultimate das, and we have to work within that framework. So insofar as he gave us certain enjoyments and certain pleasures that we have, we certainly should not throw them away. This is part of the system of Kiyam Amin. So we should enjoy them. But at the same time, we must recognize that these are not ultimates, but they are here to give us satisfaction and enjoyment, and it's a part of our chaye shaw that we have in this existence. And Chazal say, but this just comes back, and basically whatever we do in raising children always comes back to the system of the Torah, that the that insofar as these enjoyments are concerned, there's to go into extremes either way is completely wrong. I mean, that's the parsha of Nazir. That's the parsha of Nazir, that the person is a chote because he's a rasmum and a yayin. So God gave yayin, and the person will say, I'm not going to partake of any yayin, I'm not going to enjoy drinking wine, so then he's a chote. So if a person on the other hand is a zolo v'sove, so he's a rasha, he's a moshkas. So there again, the system of the time, that's exactly what the Rambam mentions with regard to how a person should be. namely, the person has to have the equilibrium. There is no, what people in this society look for is extremes. Extremes is wrong. Has to be, and that's what the Rambam keeps emphasizing and re-emphasizing, because only in the equilibrium are you in a position to partake of God's system and the enjoyments He gave you in the Chayei Shoah, and at the same time will not lose sight of what the ultimate reality is, that namely, this is really here because it's God's plan of Kiyam Amin. And the truth of the matter is that the ultimate reflection, and this is a reflection that leads a person to Avas Hashem, is when a person appreciates the way the system is and God's chokhma in creating the system so that you can have a certain pleasure and the Kiyam Amin can go on. When a person has that reflection, that is already a reflection that brings them into the realm of Avas Hashem. So that's how I would answer that. That's how I would answer that question. If there's any detail that I glossed over, not addressed adequately, so just point it out. Okay. If a person, that's what Gemara Esau Chazal say, the Yishalmi says that if a person can't enjoy life, he's a Balmum. The person should be able to enjoy life. There is, on the contrary, what HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that's what the Yishalmi says, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will take a person to din and say, I gave you this enjoy, why didn't you enjoy it? It's like a person is, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, if a person gives you something and you, something good and you spit in their face, I mean, that's a bazillion. So on the contrary, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave you the ability to enjoy something and enjoy a child and you don't enjoy it, I mean, that's a chait. It's a chait. It's not normal. It's a chait. The person is a balmum. Person has to be able to enjoy it and yet at the same time recognize what the place in reality of that enjoyment is. That's the proper answer. Okay? It's not a simple formula, but it's the correct formula. Okay. Now, should a proper, perfected, ideal mother be happy, inherently content raising young children, or is the happiness for some people really in knowing that they're engaging in an activity that partakes of reality, but will only provide real happiness in the future when enjoying the company of adult children? Okay, all right. My objection to the question is, and I don't mean by way of being, disparaging, I just mean logically. The word happiness is inappropriate here. Because happiness really, as we said before, can only be attained through the ultimate experience of Avas Hashem. Okay? But that is something, again, which shows you how the philosophy of the society permeates our way of thinking. And I'm not saying that the writer meant it this way. The writer may have just used the word casually. But the fact is that most people do think of it that way. You see that, this is happiness, a family, and this is where you're going to get your happiness from. It's not where you're going to get your happiness from. If a person tries to get the happiness from there, they're doomed, basically. It's not enough, and it's just they're fooling themselves, and ultimately the worst disasters occur from that. From taking something and trying to make it into something that it's not, okay, and investing tremendous energy into that area. Happiness is only from Yedias Hashem. That's the Avas Hashem, Yedias Hashem, and understanding Chachmas Hashem. That's the real happiness. But there is an enjoyment, I would say. I would substitute the word enjoyment. There is an enjoyment, as I said before, from children, from raising children. And I would say this, and that's why I think the writer over here is on target, and they got to the nucleus of something which is very significant. And that is if you want to look at it, once you put it in the framework of enjoyment, the truth of the matter is, as strange as it sounds, but the more energy a person puts in to this institution in terms of trying to make it their happiness, the worse it's going to be in the future. And the more realistically they deal with it, the more enjoyment they're going to get out of it ultimately. Okay, so it is true that there is no question about it that it is one of the greatest enjoyments in life to have children that are well, chachamim, intelligent, and I don't mean to say they have to have the highest IQ. I'm talking about derech ha-chochma, that they follow the derech ha-Torah. You can share with them in your life is an extremely great enjoyment of life. And it's an enjoyment which is a good enjoyment because it's an enjoyment which leads ultimately, if your derech ha-chaim is proper, to a sharing of ideas and chochma and a way of life, a derech ha-chaim in general, even in Sichas Chulin, and it's something which can afford a person, to my mind, one of the greatest enjoyments in life. And that is true, ultimately, I would say, like I would use what Chazal say, to paraphrase, self covered lover. That as difficult as it is in the early years, is a tremendous input of energy, but the rewards, if one is successful, in the later period of life are immense. And it gives a person unbelievable enjoyment in terms of the sphere of psychological enjoyment. And which is something which is, as I said, not just an enjoyment, but if it's tied in properly to the Derech HaChayim, it really is something which can bring a person to greater heights in Chochmas HaTorah itself. Okay, which is a tremendous advantage, without a doubt. So there, I think what the person's question is correct, that a person should look at it that way. A person, not to say that a person shouldn't enjoy the little enjoyments that they have along the way, but they should realize that if they are successful, that ultimately the gain will be immense. Is tremendous. That is correct. There's nothing wrong with a person realizing that that's so, because that is the case in reality. And ultimately, whether the person will have such a situation, of course, is not only dependent on what they do, but it's dependent on a lot of factors, and everybody has bechira, so it's not something which is a guaranteed result. I mean, it depends on the chelik that a Kadosh Baruch Hu really designates for the individual in this existence. So there are many things that can prevent it. It's not something that can be guaranteed, but it's something which a person should certainly have in mind as a possibility for something which is one of the, as I said, to my mind, one of the greatest enjoyments in life, and one which is not only an enjoyment, but which can lead to tremendous benefits in terms of Torah as well. So in that sense, a person should realize that what they're engaging in is a tremendous potential. And yes, that's correct. So as difficult as it is in the early years in terms of what you have to put in, the reward is an unbelievable reward. If the person is successful, and if HaKadosh Baruch Hu helps them to be successful, and all the other ingredients that are necessary, because this is one ingredient, there are many, many ingredients that are necessary. And, as I said before, everybody has Bechira, so no matter what you do, every child is an Adam and has Bechira, and that's not under a person's control. But certainly, what the person does is extremely, extremely significant and can result in tremendous benefits. But again, you have to have perspective of what the situation is, and it's not a guaranteed thing, and you have to realize, the person has a realistic expectations about it, but the fact is that the input is tremendously significant, and the benefits are unbelievably great. So that's something which I think is correct. Good. That's a good point. Yeah. These two questions, first, I think they're more generic. I mean, but now we have, again, some specific questions. Question over here is raised. Question is that some children don't seem to demand a lot of attention. Other children demand a lot of attention. And the question is that are these differences in disposition that exist in reality, or is it just your chelik as a parent, which type of child you have? Okay. Okay. Is there something wrong with easy kids who never fight, and who don't throw a fit in the store? Okay. I just want to stop on that one. Don't care. I want to stop on that one. Okay. Again. I mean, I'm being very scrutinizing here, and I don't mean to be critical. But the fact is that you see, when you say like throw a fit in the store, it's over here. We're going into we're crossing boundaries, because really, if you're in the world of the child, then it shouldn't make any difference where the child throws a fit. But for the parent, it makes a difference that it's in the store. So this over here, this is something which, again, I want to caution you. That goes back to the first principle. Namely, that when a person is involved in raising a child, the store shouldn't play any role. Plus, the child doesn't know too much about business. I don't think he understands what a retail shop is So therefore, the store element must be recognized as you and not the child, and should not come into play in terms of how you're raising the child. Okay?
Yep, I mean, of course. After the first time, it's in the child's world.
Right. What do you mean? Exactly. Okay. Now I'm speaking obviously about a child at a very young age. I'm not speaking about a 14-year-old. Okay. So this was the first part of this question was a very simple one. Is there something wrong with easy kids? That I say no. But I haven't seen any. That's the only problem. I don't think there's such a thing as easy kids, but I do think, and this I think is this perhaps is something which a person I think should consider and is significant, and that is that there is no question that the disposition of a child is not up to you, and the disposition of a child is a very strong innate component, and I really believe, this is my personal opinion, is that the disposition is not a result of how you raise the child. But the disposition factor is one which is a given, and there's very, very little you can do about it. And in other words, I do not think that when you look at an adult, that he is 90% rearing and 10% disposition. I would say it's the opposite, if anything. The opposite would be closer. Although, I have to qualify that. It's not that simple either, because it depends what that 10% is. I mean, there's a tremendous interaction between the disposition and between the, I'm just trying to emphasize the fact that I really think that this innate disposition is a very powerful phenomenon, and it's not one that you really are in control of or can make a choice about. And it is true. There are children whose dispositions are such that I wouldn't say an easy disposition, because an easy disposition implies that there's something objective about this child's disposition that's easy. That's only to the parent that's easy. It's not really a quality in the disposition. Okay? You understand what I'm saying? Again, I think it's important to think clearly about these things. So a lot of the terms that people use show that you're not thinking properly. Not any. Like you say, a good child. A good child, the child that goes to sleep on time and stays asleep all night. It has nothing to do with a good child. I mean, it's good for you. So a child may have a disposition which is easy for an adult to raise. That's a totally different thing. I mean, that idea must be very clear. Okay? Because if you don't have that idea, what you start doing is you start projecting onto the child your own irritations. And that's, if you move in that direction, you're really going to harm the child. If your mind moves in that direction, the important thing is for the person to have at all times, I mean, not just the emotional equilibrium, but the avoidance of the blind spots that the emotional distortion will cause. In other words, the knowledge. Okay? So you have to have the knowledge in front of your mind's eye at all times. Namely, that the child has a certain disposition, whether it's easy to raise or not easy, that happens to be completely extraneous to the child, okay? It's extraneous. So therefore, the person must understand that there are children whose dispositions are such that it is much easier, much less effort, on the part of the parent to raise such a child. Now, that's absolutely true. It can't be denied. That's a fact. And there could be a great disparity. I mean, you could have your own two children, one of them very, very difficult, and one of them very easy. It doesn't mean one child is better than the other. It just means that one child's disposition is such that it requires great effort and a great input of energy, and the other one's does not. That's just the way it is. Okay? Fact is that the one compensating feature I would say is that on the whole, it probably, I mean, I would just say off the top of my head, I mean, I'm not, you want to be held to it, but probably a child whose disposition is difficult is one who also not always but for the most part has strong capabilities and usually it's a type of a child that has great potential because it means that they're very intense. The emotions are intense. If they're channeled properly, they can really be very, very productive. But doesn't mean to say, on the other hand, that you can't have an easy child that could also be just as productive. I mean, it's not that simple. But the fact is that an intense child is one which is not a bad thing, because it does require a lot of input of energy, but it also shows a very, very strong emotions, which means that if they're guided properly, can lead to a very type of productive life. It can be an indication of great ability and, great potential. So that is something which I think a parent should realize, or that, you know, that even though it's difficult, but there may be great benefits involved. And it's not something which is bad, even though it is very taxing. But there's no question about it. There are those differences, and you can't. In other words, it would be wrong to blame yourself and think that the child is very demanding and very difficult, that that's your fault and you haven't done the right thing in raising the child from the early years. That's not necessarily true. I mean, it could be true. It could be that, you know, the parent is many times the cause of their own problems if they don't raise the child properly, but it's not necessarily true. Demanding child could be because of the child's nature. And the nature of a child is something which you can't do anything about. It's just, that's the way it is. Okay. I didn't really address the issue of attention. Okay. The issue of attention is one which is a difficult one to put forth in a formula. But it's one which is very important. I would say like this. It's very difficult to express it because it's so individual. The only thing is this. I would say that's why I say you have to know yourself. The best guide, I would say, is if you know yourself and you know that the input is based upon the child's world that you understand, then the amount of attention that you're going to give the child will probably be right. I do think that parents have a good Sechel Hayashar, if their emotions are not in the right, are not in the place where they're serving their own goals. You understand what I'm saying? If it's not in the wrong place, I think the intuition of a parent is usually pretty good. So therefore, if the person knows themselves and the person is not doing something to the child for their own goals, their own problems, to try to resolve their own problems in life, but it really is based upon an understanding of the world of the child, I think they will give the child the proper attention, the amount which is necessary and not an overly large amount. An overly large amount of attention is very bad, and on the other, that's usually probably the mistake that parents make, is to give more attention, in our society that is, than the child really should be getting, and that is not good. In general, I'd say to get away to say it in words is very difficult because it could always be misconstrued. But the point is that a child's desire for attention is endless. And if you ever went along with the child's desire for attention, you would destroy the child, without a question. That's why Chazal say, with regard to Tinoch, is Makar v'Minim, Merachi v'Smol. That that. On the one hand, you have to be, you have to show them the attention. On the other hand, you have to push them away, which means to say there's an equilibrium there. And there's, you're always going to be in a state of limbo. If the child is satisfied, it's bad. If the child is neglected, it's bad. Either way. Now, therefore, you must ride a middle course over there. But the middle course, you see, is only possible, to my mind, if the person isn't trying to resolve their own conflicts through the child. Like if, for instance, a person has a desire, a person has a tremendous desire for attention themselves. Everybody does. So the thing is, a person tries to gain that attention that they're looking for themselves vicariously through the child, which means they identify with the child, and therefore the attention they're giving the child, they're really receiving. So they're actually giving and receiving at the same time, which sounds crazy, but psychologically it's absolutely true. So if a person is resolving their own conflicts through giving the child attention, then I think they're not going to be able to they're not going to be able to administer the proper amount of attention. And you know, that's why I say so much is dependent upon the person's knowledge of themselves, because the love of a child is not one which is unselfish. I do not believe that. I believe that the love of a child is a very selfish involvement. I would say that from what I see in society today, that most people in raising a family, that the major, if you say what the major motivation is to gain a sense of self-importance. And the self-importance, most people are not that important in the outside world, and they gain self-importance through raising a family, and the family looks up to them, and it's a tool of their own self-worth, which is a very bad thing, very bad thing. Okay, that's what you'll notice. A lot of times people that are, you know, do get tremendous recognition, they, a lot of times they abandon their families. The reason is because that recognition is really giving them more self-worth than the average person who doesn't have that recognition, who will have to resort to the recognition from the family. In the family, they're important. So people want to be important, want to feel important. A way to become very important easily is to have a lot of children, and you're very important because they all look up to you. But it doesn't work for a while. For a while, it'll work. And usually it backfires. In the long run, it backfires. But the fact is that that motivation cannot be overlooked. And I think if a person denies that motivation, then they're not being honest with themselves. And in not being honest with themselves, what happens is that they will indulge in this type of activity, and in the long run, it's going to backfire. I mean, people who do that most of the time, unless the child falls into some kind of neurotic state, and then they have other problems, it's going to backfire. So again, if a person raises children properly, the rewards are great. But if you get caught in it, you get caught up in satisfying your own emotions, it's ultimately it's just not going to work. That is almost guaranteed. That sense you can guarantee that it won't work. But so I think that's a very important thing for a person to recognize. Their own motivations, and if a person denies they have that motivation, then again, they're not being honest with themselves. The Derech HaTorah is not to deny your emotions, but to recognize them and to recognize that you're not blamed for having an emotion. Nothing wrong with having an emotion of any kind. That is not an avera. It's what you do with it. It's how you handle it. Okay? Every person has all kinds of emotions, and this is given to us by God. So there's nothing wrong with them. It's what you do with them which makes it good or bad. And a person has to recognize that they have a tremendous need for recognition. It's a part of human life. I mean, that's the whole world revolves around that. I mean, and if you don't recognize that emotion, then you just fool yourself. But the proper way is to recognize it and to make sure that you keep an eye on it and that it's channeled into a productive area, which ultimately, again, will be productive in terms of that emotion itself will be more productive. Okay, it's like by Yosef HaTzadik, that what stopped Yosef HaTzadik from indulging in having an affair with Eishes Potiphar? What stopped him was when he thought that, why am I doing this? This is a tremendous ego boost, but the fact is I'm going to be losing my name on the Choshen Mishpat. So it really doesn't pay. The trade-off isn't worth it. Same thing is true over here. that if a person gives in to their momentary need for recognition in raising a child, ultimately they're going to lose. And if they, it's an ironic kind of thing, but if they control the emotion, ultimately they gain. It's a strange kind of a thing, but if you understand life, you understand how things work that way. Okay, yeah. Okay, yeah, that's actually the next question. It happens to be, that's not the next question. So you think along the same lines. Okay, the question, should a parent scream or plan what a child is being exposed to? Okay, here especially a very bright child. So a bright child is absorbing and learning from everything that's around them. All right? Like, for instance, they mentioned the characters on Sesame Street. You know, things like that. I mean, these are important questions. Or should it, and now here the one that wrote this one says, or should a parent try to see to it that a child's head is filled with information that is more of a foundation for the future, insofar as it's filling itself with whatever's around? Okay? All right. And let me address the last part of it, okay? First. All right? The thing is that the answer to that question is like this, that that I don't think a parent should look at a child in a way that they're preparing them to be like let's say to be a Talmud Chacham, you know, in the future. I don't think that's a good idea. In other words, I don't think that a parent should say, okay, I'm going to lay the foundation right now, like fill their mind with ideas so that, you know, they're going to be the Talmid Chacham. It's not going to work because what you have to address is the level of the child at the time, okay? And there, the danger of thinking in those terms is again the danger of trying to think that you can guarantee what this person is going to be in life, you see, and then it comes into your own, then you're operating based upon your own ego again. You want to, of course, everybody wants to have children that are, you know, great children in the Derech HaTorah, whether they're sons or daughters. They should be, you know, Chachomim, and they should live the proper Derech HaChayim. I mean, everybody wants that. And but the thing is, at a young age, you shouldn't be thinking about that. Okay, shouldn't be thinking, okay, I'm going to make this person into a Talmid Chacham. That usually works against you, because what it is your own ego is involved. It's an indication that your own ego is involved, and then you're going to work based upon your own ego, and you're going to do things. I often think, I mean, I see even among the people in our yeshiva, where they think that they could take a child and they're going to sort of give them like a head start. You know, use certain tricks to give them a head start. Teach him a Reb Chaim's question when he's five. So this way he'll really be, you know, and he's going to be a tremendous Talmid Chacham. We'll give him the tricks of the trade early. So, you know, this is, not only doesn't it work, it always works against you, I would say. Because it shows that the parent is under the influence of this desire, and they're not working in terms of the child, they're working in terms of their own desire. And it has to lead to disaster. What happens is, most of the time, it will lead to the child being turned off to Chachma, unfortunately. Because I just want to mention to you that a child's sensitivity is unbelievable, and it's something which we cannot fully grasp as adults. But it is unbelievable, it's beyond our own perception, because we're not in that world at our stage. But we can know that it is extremely sensitive. And any time the child senses, I don't care how much you sugarcoat it, but any time the child senses that you are on a campaign to use him or her for your purposes, it's going to backfire. Has to backfire, you see? And therefore, this type of thinking in the parent, this type of thinking must be eradicated. And I'm saying you have to, you have to work on yourself, examine yourself. There's nothing more important than that. And you have to remove certain types of thinking. And if you don't do it, I don't care if you control it in one instance, it's going to get you... Today, you do one thing, but eventually you're going to get caught. So the thing is extremely important to be aware of yourself and your own motivations. And the person has to raise a child in a way which they know there's no guarantee that they're going to be a Talmid Chacham. And if they're not Talmid Chacham, then you could live with that too. You have your own life. You have to have your own life and your own Avos Hashem, and that should be central. if you have Birkas Hashem and you have this additional wonderful aspect of your life, very good, you're blessed. But the fact is that this can't be your life. See, this cannot be your life. It has to. You have to raise the child, and if the child is going to be a truck driver, fine, be a truck driver. That's it. There's nothing. A person should not feel that they would have less love for their child. You understand? I mean, in the sense that their obligations and their feelings toward their basic feeling towards the child should be the same, whatever the child becomes. It's not. It shouldn't be. The love of the child should not be. Should be able to think of a child in a way that the love of the child should not be dependent upon what this child's going to be. That's a very big way of thinking. You know, this child's going to be a chacham. I'm really going to. The child. It's an obligation you have to present this, to place before this individual the most optimum situation for their own development. And again, as I said, the person, every child is going to become an adult that has their own bechira, and you can't do too much about bechira. Bechira is totally free will. So you can't do that. You can't have your mind set on what this child is going to be, and that's why you love this child. And then the moment the child appears, the child is not going to fulfill that goal, so then you're going to withdraw the love. This is very detrimental, very detrimental. And you have to really be able to think about it in terms of what is optimal at this point for the child's environment. That's it, okay? And in my opinion, it's not to stuff their minds with information. I mean, these things have been done. People try to teach kids to, not just in the atmosphere, but in the other sphere, in other spheres, teach kids to read newspapers at the age of 2 and 3 and produce geniuses, but... all these things are utter nonsense, and they're very detrimental. I mean, they followed up a lot of the lives of these kids, and they're really distraught and destroyed. I mean, terrible, terrible. You just have to work with the important thing to do is to let the child lead the way. If you raise a child normally, a child enjoys a question, and if you're honest and intelligent in handling the child's question properly, then you will be successful. But let the child has a curiosity. And a child asks questions, very hard to answer the question. Very hard, not so easy to answer the question. I mean, my younger granddaughter asked me a question last week, and I simply couldn't answer it. So she went to ask Pacey. But a question was a childish question, but it's not easy to answer. A question was a simple question. It says, we are down here on Earth, and the stars are in the sky. She says, but really, we're the third planet, you know, because she saw, you know, on television, and we're also in the sky. So are we down here, or are we up there? See? It's a good question. Good question for a child, but it's not easy to answer.
I mean, relativity.
Not easy to answer.
She wanted to know the theory of relativity.
Not easy to answer. So I didn't answer the question yet, I'll tell you the truth. I have to really think about what the proper way to present the answer. I mean, you know, it's a child's question, but you have to go into the mind of the child, and to the adult it may sound, a child's question may sound silly, but to the child's mind, it's extremely significant. And again, what you have to do is, if you want to really help the child, what you should do is not to stifle the child when the child expresses the curiosity, and on their level, not Reb Chaim. You know, to teach child Reb Chaim is to take the child's mind and try to you're going to jump the stages, you know. This child's going to be Reb Chaim's level, because we'll, you know, skip all these other things and we'll go right to Reb Chaim. See? That is a very, very poor approach. Very poor approach. Okay. So again, that's why, again, I think that honesty is very important. And honesty is extremely important. And you don't worry so much about breaking the child's image that they have of you. Okay? If you answer the question a day later, it's not going to be so terrible. But on the contrary, if you're dishonest and you just try to maintain the child's image of you, and you answer the question improperly, then you're really playing with the child's mind, and you're distorting their natural curiosity and their own development. So I think, again, honesty is the best thing. Honesty is the best thing. And what I mean, when I taught in high school, one of the best compliments I ever got, a Talmud came over to me and said, I really want to compliment you as a Rebbe. You're one of the best Rebbeim I've ever had. So I was very happy to hear that. And they said, okay, you tell me why. So he says, because you're the only Rebbe that I've had that says he doesn't know. It's all kind of funny. But, anyway. but the truth is, yeah, I told him so many ideas of things. But the truth is, Mitalmida Yosef Mikulam, and I learned from that how much a Talmud, and this was an intelligent high school word, how much a Talmud appreciates honesty. That's basically what it is, right? Okay. So I think that's true on all levels. That's true on all levels, yes. I would say this. You see, again, I think, like, you know, assessment, what do you expose a child to? I think I really, in that score, I trust a parent's intuition. If the parent is not involved in their own problems, trying to resolve their own problems through their child, I think a parent's intuition is very good. I have a great respect for a parent's intuition. A mother's intuition is unbelievable. You see, the Torah says that. There's a bina yesera there. And then that is absolutely true, provided the parent is not involved in their, again, trying to resolve their own conflicts. But if they're really involved in the child, most parents have tremendous insight and they'll know exactly what to do. And they'll be able to assess the level of the child. If Sesame Street is good for the child on this level, if they just think about it properly and in terms of the framework of the child, I think they're going to make the right decision. And I think to expose a child to things on television, which obviously are not appropriate for the child, I think a parent's intuition is very good in that area. You don't have to be choker v'doreish too much. I think in our society, Baruch Hashem, we have people that are bali secho, and they know what is good for a child to see, and there's certain things on television I don't have to tell you are horrible for a child, without a doubt. And I think that people here have enough sense to know, you know, to be able to make an appropriate decision. As long as you're not, don't be filled with the idea that you have to fill this child with knowledge. That's not what you have to do. You have to, things that are appropriate on their age level, you know, which they'll gain from. There are many very good things on television, wonderful things on television. I don't think the ultimate is on television. I don't think it can't be on television, but I don't think it is. But that's because I don't think that our society has the level of chokhmah and the level of knowledge of education that Chazal have and that we have through a Masorah Sinai of what really education and what really knowledge is. I think to the world has a mistaken idea that the college system and the system of presenting facts and, you know, and formulas and absorbing and sounding very intelligent, that is not what we recognize as chachma. Okay? We recognize the profundity of chachma, and understanding one idea and appreciating one idea is much more important than having an encyclopedic mind that you just rattle off. That's not education to us. I think the world doesn't really have any concept of what real chachma is. So on that score, I would say you're not going to find that on television. But a lot of other things are very good, and a lot of other things are very good for a child. And those things which are good, and the child likes it, that's the main thing. And the child enjoys it and is good, fine. I think a parent's intuition in that area is, in our society, thank God, is very trustworthy. Don't feel that the child at an early age, again, that this is an opportunity to rush knowledge into them to make them into a great chacham. That would be a terrible, terrible mistake. And it never works. Yes. Alright. This is another thing. A parent should not feel, okay? A parent should not feel that this is, again, an important thing. Disciplining a child is not bad. It's good. And there is nothing wrong. There's nothing wrong with disciplining a child in the proper way. Okay? Catering to a child and babying a child is very bad. It's extremely bad. A spoiled child is not good. It's not good. Very bad. It's the basis for future psychological problems. it's extremely important not to be afraid, you see, not to cater to every whim of a child. I mean, if you're afraid of that, I tell you, it's your own emotions. It's nothing more, it's just your own wishes, that you wish that you could have everything you want, and you're just expressing it in the way you're related to the child. But it has no basis in reality. Now, if a child is doing something which is harmful to themselves or to others, they must be restricted. The way to do it is, I think I mentioned last time, is to restrict them, and firmly restrict them. It is not proper to make it if a child, like I think one of the questions that was raised there, what do you do with a child that says, one child says to a child, and I say to the sibling, I want to kill you, I'm going to destroy you, I'm going to murder you, I'm going to cut your head off, children can say all these things. You have to understand, when a child says they're going to cut another child's head off, it's not what we, as we conceive of doing that. You know? It's on a different plane. Okay, again, you have to go into the world of the child. So if you're going to make this, you're going to tell the child, you want to cut this child, you want to cut your brother's head off, you're a vicious killer, murder, no. Okay. Then you're going to adversely affect the child. There's no question. When parents do that, I think they're really lazy. Because what they're trying to do is instill a tremendous guilt in the child in order that they shouldn't have to be bothered with these problems. It may work temporarily, but in the long run, the parent is going to pay the price. So the parent has to not be afraid of being restrictive and firm, okay? Firm and restrictive. You must prevent it. You want to put the child in the room, put them in their room. You could be restrictive and preventive and very firm about it. And you can't allow a child to do anything that's dangerous to themselves. If you have to pull them off the street, you pull them off the street. If you have to put them in a house, make them stay in a house, fine. There's nothing wrong with that. Okay? There's nothing wrong with restricting the activity of a child and making it clear to a child can't do something even though they don't understand what it is. Even though they may not understand why they can't do it. That is a big mistake, to think that a child must understand everything that the parent is doing, because it's virtually impossible. So they want to run in the street because they don't understand what it means to get killed by a car. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. A person has, there's nothing wrong with restrictions. Restrictions are very good, because restrictions teach a person to keep again, goes back to what the Rambam says, to be in between. That you don't, you're not totally satisfied and you're not totally unsatisfied. You have to have that state. That middle road is really learned in childhood to a very great degree. And if you're going to cater to a child's every whim, then you're not going to allow them later in life and to be able to have deferred gratifications. They're not going to be able to be in that middle road. So you really can be helpful to them in raising them, to allow them to realize that there's a certain amount of frustration, because life has frustration. You have to tolerate frustration. If a person can't tolerate frustration in life, they can't live in this world. So that's something which has to be learned from infancy on. And it's an important lesson. It mustn't be done in a cruel way, in a vicious way, but it must be done in a proper way, and it's something which you should not be afraid of. It's a very good thing for the child. Okay? Well, that's a thing. I mean, these things are, again, I think that, I mean, there's certain problems that are very hard to resolve. I mean, one of them is a parent getting sleep at night. It's a very, very difficult, problem. But again, it's something which you have to view in terms of the child's world. And the best recommendation that I personally think is that a child, there's nothing wrong with a child crying, but there is a certain kind of a cry that I don't think is good for a child. There's a crying, and then there's a cry which is I think a mother knows what that cry is, you know, and the father may know also from the fact that the mother complains about it. But it's a certain kind of cry. It is a certain kind of a cry which I don't think is healthy. In other words, I think that to let a child cry is fine, but there has to be it's a quantitative matter. It has to be a degree. And the way to do it is to do, if you're going to make any changes, it should be done very slowly. Not abruptly. Not abrupt kind of changes, which are, traumatic in terms of the child. An education of a child from infancy should be even. Very important it should be even. Shouldn't be abrupt changes. You know, suddenly one day this way, one day that way. You know, now you spoil. I spoil the child. Okay, so now let the child cry all night. That I do not think is very advisable. But I think that.